All right, we got to talk about Tandem because this really is a change that I saw in clinical investigators over the last few months and when this data was first starting to be presented. And there was some serious confusion in medical oncologists. John, how are you thinking through this decision in a non-protocol setting right now based on the Tandem data?
Well, I want to preface my remarks with the fact that I work in a Canadian setting, and we've reviewed the evidence for trastuzumab usage beyond progression and decided that it doesn't pass the mustard. So essentially, we have one kick at the cat with trastuzumab for a woman with metastatic breast cancer. So that means one course of therapy. So that explains why, in my practice, I still think that the standard of care is where the overall survival advantages have been demonstrated, and that is in combination chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. So looking at this woman with liver metastases, my reaction a year ago would have been to give chemotherapy, highly effective chemotherapy, plus trastuzumab because of a demonstrated overall survival advantage, probably on the order of 9 to 12 months if you look at the MARTI data and looking at the wonderful survivals we're getting from the BCIRG007 as well TCH data from Robert. So given the Tandem data, that doesn't really change my approach for the average woman who comes in at age 60 with visceral metastases, particularly given that we did an unplanned subgroup analysis of women with liver metastases, and they did not appear to benefit from the addition of trastuzumab in terms of overall survival. It was the women without liver metastases that might have had a survival advantage from the addition of trastuzumab. So for a young woman with visceral metastases, I would recommend her to begin chemotherapy plus our one kick at the cat with trastuzumab for the proven overall survival advantage.
And at what point would you incorporate an AI, if at all, in that? Would you add that in the beginning, later, or what?
Well, I'm a trialist by training and by practice, and the trials do not, in metastatic settings, switch people over to hormonal therapy for maintenance. One treats with chemo, in this case plus Herceptin, and then one waits till we have progression before we call this patient as a progressor, and only then do you initiate other treatments.
So just to clarify, the asymptomatic patient, but you would start on chemo and trastuzumab because of the visceral mets?
A 60-year-old woman with liver metastases, that would be my advice to her. If she were not willing to go through chemotherapy, then I would certainly talk to her about the Tandem study.
And then, let's say she didn't have visceral mets, she just had bone mets. Still chemo and trastuzumab?
The proven benefit in terms of survival is still with chemotherapy. I have one use of trastuzumab. I have one bullet in this cylinder. And at the end of the day, the benefits in terms of overall survival, notwithstanding the Tandem trial, which I think is an interesting study, still comes from chemotherapy. So the woman has to know proven survival is with chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. If she does not want to undergo that, I certainly discuss the Tandem option with her, but she needs to know that she's foregoing a possible survival advantage.
Paul?
I want to remind people that in the HER2-negative population, one of the most elegantly demonstrated points of the upfront aromatase inhibitor trials was that visceral metastases respond extremely well in HER2-negative disease. And if the patient's asymptomatic with liver metastases, I only make this point because I'm aware that in clinical practice, there are many people who still revert to chemotherapy because a patient has two or three asymptomatic liver metastases. And I need to remind people that the response and benefit to aromatase inhibitors in that type of setting is excellent and should be tried. It's outside of the discussion we're having here.
I think it's pretty relevant to the discussion. Joe, how do you approach these patients, asymptomatic patients, metastatic disease? Do you start the patient on chemotherapy?
No, I agree with Paul entirely that endocrine therapy would be the default position. With regard to the HER2 issue, I would favor saving that single bullet in the chamber for a time when I need to use chemotherapy because of the clear benefit when trastuzumab is added to chemotherapy with regard to objective response, time to progression, and overall survival, and not use it at a point in time when I'm administering endocrine therapy where I think there's less potential for benefit and where I also have to tie the patient to getting a parenteral therapy in addition to an oral therapy that's well tolerated.
So you're saying endocrine therapy without trastuzumab?
Yes.
Mark?
Well, I mean, I think if you follow your patients very closely, as all of us do, then that would be on the table as a treatment option and would be available to discussion with the patient, particularly in light of the fact of its convenience, et cetera. But what we have to recognize from the Tandem trial is the expectation from that single-agent AI is modest in that the time of benefit is short for the vast majority of patients. And as long as you capture those early progressions in a timely fashion and treat them with trastuzumab-based therapy, which is arguably the most important of the targeted therapies that you're going to use in these patients, then that's fine. So close clinical follow-up is the key to management of these patients if you're not going to start with a trastuzumab-based regimen. Outside of that caveat, I think my preference would be to use the trastuzumab-based regimen up front. And I think I probably would start with an aromatase inhibitor in this particular case because of its lack of side effects relative to cytotoxic therapy. So I maybe have a little bit of a departure from John's point. The point there, however, is that we really don't have any data on what the response to chemo Herceptin is after endocrine trastuzumab combinations. And the data we do have of single agent trastuzumab followed by chemotherapy, for example, some work done by Denise Yardley and Skip Burrows published a few years ago in the JCO suggests that when you introduce chemotherapy in trastuzumab-treated patients, you still maintain a very high response rate. I think they used a paclitaxel carboplatin addition to trastuzumab-treated metastatic breast cancers and had a response rate, I believe, of about 65% even after trastuzumab. So if you extrapolate that into AI plus trastuzumab-treated patients, which is a leap of faith, I'll grant you, I think you might still be able to capture reasonable salvage responses with chemo trastuzumab following a run-in with endocrine therapy plus trastuzumab.
Let me just clarify, though. Asymptomatic patient with metastatic disease, Mark, are you saying you most likely would use an AI and trastuzumab?
I most likely would, yes. I think trastuzumab is the most important component of these patients' treatment because of its association with improved survival, albeit in combination with chemotherapy with the data we have, but I'll bet you in non-chemotherapy trials you would see the same thing. Trastuzumab is a very important component of targeted therapy for HER2-positive patients, and arguably more important than the endocrine manipulation in terms of its impact.
It's interesting you think about the quality of life implications of second opinions. Go to one doctor, you're going to get chemo. Another doctor, you're going to get hormones alone. Hormones and trastuzumab, pretty big difference in quality of life. Mara?
Yeah, and very confusing for patients, you can imagine. But I agree with Mark. I mean, it would have been nice to have a trial of combination versus single agent sequential therapy, but that's not how this study was designed, and we're not going to get the answer to that. The median went from 2.4 to 4.8 months. There was really a doubling of the median, and obviously some patients are going to derive most of that benefit and others aren't going to derive any at all. And without being able to select those patients up front, I have come around to feel that I probably will give the combination of trastuzumab and an AI up front because I do know that some people will derive a great benefit and will be the ones on the tail of that curve. And until I know who those are and can select them when I'm starting therapy, I probably will give the combination initially. I also feel that giving hormonal therapy is very important. I like to delay chemotherapy as much as possible. I've had patients in my practice with metastatic disease for 8 to 10 years, and I think it's important to be able to delay the onset of chemotherapy because I think it has a big impact on quality of life.
I'm going to ask Eric to make the final comment.
I'll just be very clear about this. I didn't find the TANDEM study to be practice-changing to any significant degree. Prior to TANDEM, I would use very selectively an AI in some patients. Prior to TANDEM, I would use selectively trastuzumab monotherapy in some patients. And most patients with HER2-positive disease in my clinical practice get some form of chemotherapy with trastuzumab for the reasons that have been described, and I will continue to do that. I suppose there may be a very rare patient for whom I might give the combination, but it's going to be a very, very rare patient. And most of those patients, I think I'll actually give an AI to alone still and then come in with chemotherapy and trastuzumab.
Okay.
Neil, can I just make one comment on this? I tend to lean a bit more towards John in this, in that if you look at the, bearing in mind the caveat of doing cross-trial comparisons, the TTPs on most of the chemo plus trastuzumab regimens up front are of the order of about 11 months. On the carbotaxol trastuzumab, it was about 14. On similarly, Mark, with yours, with I think the 006. On, I believe, Matt, your trial on the letrozole trastuzumab, it was 5.8. And in TANDEM, I think it was also 5.8 in the ER positive centrally confirmed. If you're doing cross-trial comparisons, it's around 11, 12 versus of the order of 5.5. And I do believe you've got your best shot up front. So I would tend for those with visceral, symptomatic, or asymptomatic to start more with chemotrastuzumab. But for the ones with a bone pain or asymptomatic, those are the ones I'd consider much more towards an AI plus trastuzumab.
Okay, really final comment, Matt.
Breast cancer is a chronic disease and incurable. And I think it behooves us to find therapies that are well tolerated, that can be given for long periods of time. And what's striking about this data is there's a subpopulation of patients that without chemotherapy receive extremely durable benefit from this biological combination. And so if you can select the patients on all the criteria you mentioned, Brian, and delay chemotherapy for 2, 3, or 4 years, that's very meaningful to the patient. And so for me, there's a larger group of patients who I offer this to than there are in Eric Weiner's population, I guess. And every metastatic patient's a bit different, but I've been using this a lot, and I think that patients definitely seem to do, a subpopulation, do quite well. It's important to remember that there's maybe something important in the interaction in a subgroup of patients, because there's emerging data from the neoadjuvant setting that use of trastuzumab can actually increase ER expression and may even induce ER expression in ER-negative breast cancer. And this is data that's unpublished, I guess, but will emerge over the next year. And certainly in ER-negative cell lines, treatment with kinase inhibitors or trastuzumab, you can switch ER on. So there may be these patients having a long duration of benefit are the subgroup in which you've managed to modulate ER expression and increase sensitivity to the endocrine agent. Who knows?
John?
If I could just make the final parting comment on tandem, the biggest mistake you could make would be to give naked AI therapy to this patient and wait 3 months to assess response. Keep in mind, in this trial, the median time to progression was 2.4 months with aromatase inhibition. And in fact, in those with liver metastases, we haven't shown the data, the results are even worse. So at the end of the day, please, if you're going to use an AI naked for liver metastases patients, you need to be monitoring radiologically and biochemically very frequently to know that you're not going to end up in the worst of all possible situations with a woman whose hepatic function is so poor you can't give highly effective chemotherapy plus trastuzumab.
The next poll question relates to the selection of a chemotherapy trastuzumab regimen in the adjuvant setting. Of great interest is that while prior to the December San Antonio meeting, the faculty utilized regimens that included an anthracycline, since that time, and the presentation by Dr. Dennis Slayman of the second data analysis of BCIRG006, five of the faculty have now switched their standard regimen to TCH, docetaxel, carboplatin, and trastuzumab. Dr. Mackey began the discussion.
The wonderful thing about 006 is not just the fact that it's giving us a acceptable option for new patients that walk in the door, but it's a great platform on which to design the next stage of adjuvant clinical trials. And based on Mark Pegram's work, there's a lot of reason to think that one should probably attempt in the adjuvant setting to combine trastuzumab with bevacizumab. There's good preclinical data for that coming out of Mark and Dennis Slayman's laboratory. And now Mark has a very impressive phase 2 signal that those two naked antibodies in metastatic breast cancer are highly active. So the question now is, how do you bring that into the adjuvant setting? And given the propensity for bevacizumab to add hypertension to the equation of a patient who is going to get a cardiotoxic insult from other treatments, the obvious trial to do is something like TCH versus TCH plus bevacizumab. And the NSABP and the BCIRG are committed to conducting such a trial.
What I want to focus on is the control arm. It's going to be TCH?
The control arm of this trial, the design that we are moving ahead with, is one in which the control arm is TCH. And the comparator is TCH plus bevacizumab, and the trial will be powered to answer a question of whether bevacizumab adds to TCH.
So I'm going to start with Eric and ask, A, what were you doing in your practice before this? What are you doing now? And how would you feel about putting patients on the described design of TCH plus or minus bev?
So I'm fine putting patients on the trial. I have absolutely no issue with it. I think it's an entirely reasonable trial. Prior to San Antonio, I gave most patients AC followed by TH using the intergroup regimen. And actually, I still do that, although my comfort level for the patient who has a reason to make me more worried about cardiac toxicity has gone up a little bit in terms of using TCH. I haven't gone home and said, I'm now going to use TCH in everyone. We have years and thousands of patients worth of experience giving anthracyclines in this setting of HER2-positive disease, and I'm not quite ready to shift everyone. But I think it's interesting. I want to actually ask John a question, which is, do you think the carbo makes any difference? And in the ideal world, wouldn't you like to suddenly find 10,000 patients to ask whether you can give even kinder and gentler chemotherapy with trastuzumab, since my guess is that trastuzumab in the end is really the great equalizer and that the chemotherapy doesn't make a darn bit of difference as long as you give some.
And what kind of gentler therapy? Are you thinking about TC cyclophosphamide?
I'm thinking of Taxotere alone, of paclitaxel, of vinorelbine, of any agent. And I'm struck by the phenomenally negative results of 007.
The Taxotere alone Herceptin question versus TCH has been addressed in a randomized trial in metastatic breast cancer.
Yes.
And it is not kinder and gentler, because in that trial, the Taxotere was 100 per meter squared, and in the TCH arm, it's 75. So the toxicity was arguably higher in the TH arm in that study compared to the TCH arm, and the efficacy was equivalent in both arms. So in terms of therapeutic index, you could argue based on that study that TCH would still come out the winner.
So bottom line, 62-year-old woman, Mark, with a couple positive nodes, comes in perfectly healthy. What are you likely to recommend off study?
I'm definitely going to discuss both treatment options with the patients, point out the various toxicity profiles associated with each, and get the patient's impression on what they would like to choose. I mean, I would not say that the patient must have TCH, but I think it's reasonable to offer it as a treatment option. I agree with many in this room that it's reasonable to be conservative with regard to changing clinical practice based on an abstract presentation of an interim analysis. As a general rule, those are rarely practice-changing presentations, but this does bring up the issue of non-anthracycline-based chemotherapies to integrate with trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting. It puts it on the table, and it's a reasonable treatment option. I agree with Eric that trastuzumab probably is the great equalizer, and the chemo base is probably going to become a secondary issue.
What about TCH with the C being cyclophosphamide?
The U.S. Oncology Network is exploring that combination in some ongoing trials, and I think it's entirely reasonable. The hypothesis of synergy behind trastuzumab and cytotoxics extends equally into alkylating agents as it did for the platinum salts. So I think that's a reasonable substitution, and I'll be very interested to follow their data as it emerges.
Matt, how are you approaching these patients right now?
Well, before this data, I was actually carefully looked at the baseline ejection fraction and the age of the patient because of that nice analysis that was done in the NSABP study of trastuzumab showing the older the patient and the lower the baseline ejection fraction, the more likely they were going to get into trouble with congestive failure with trastuzumab. So if they looked like they were in a higher risk group, older, lower baseline ejection fraction, I was giving TCH already. But now I'm even less likely to give AC followed by T, driven by the safety data.
Again, 62-year-old healthy woman, normal ejection fraction. What are you likely to recommend?
Well, I agree with Mark. I mean, I think you have to go through the issues, and I'd emphasize at this point, I'd like to see five-year data, wouldn't we all? But at this point, I would tend more towards TCH. For those of us who've seen treatment-associated leukemia, it's an unpleasant event.
Brian?
So on this one, I'm exactly aligned with what Eric and Matthew said, but I'm here to be the provocateur. So let me just ask this directly, John, which is that a number of my colleagues are concerned with the shift in the database. So basically, the message last year on the TOPO2 co-amplified was that that population needed an anthracycline. The message on that population this year is you don't necessarily need trastuzumab in that population.
Yes,
so
I agree.
So the message coming through is maturing, and that's making some of my colleagues just worry in general, is this a shifting pattern where the pattern is going to change again in another year or so?
I thought the message was you can either choose between anthracycline or trastuzumab.
I'm being the provocateur, Neil.
The message could be that you don't need Herceptin in that group.
Would you rather take an anthracycline? Yeah.
But the therapeutic index still favors the trastuzumab regimen, so let's just make that clear. The real question that you posed, though, Brian, is a very good question, but I think it's very important to emphasize that that TOPO2 analysis last year was a retrospective subset analysis of an interim analysis where only 2/3 of the samples had actually been analyzed yet, and guess what? The p-value was not actually statistically significant.
Yes.
So that is called hypothesis-generating data, not practice-changing data. And so considering the fact that there was large error bars associated with that data set, it's of no surprise to me that we're seeing that that hypothesis generating data was just that. The hypothesis was tested now with longer follow-up, more samples, a complete data set, and the hypothesis was wrong.
And Professor Pegram, to finish that off, the current co-amplified TOPO2 set is still less than 120 events with all three arms added together.
Exactly.
Which is why my colleagues worry about whether this is a shifting scene.
That could change
Fine.
Again.
Aman?
Sure, could.
I think if we look at the patient population, which is TOPO2 overamplified HER2-new positive, it is actually 89% 3-year estimated disease-free survival with ACTH, versus in the other two arms, it is exactly 87%. So essentially, the TCH arm shows no difference. So there is numerically at least still about 2% absolute difference in favor of the anthracycline with trastuzumab.
There's no difference whatsoever in terms of a statistical analysis.
Statistical,
but the confidence limits overlap widely. So if that data was plotted on a 0 to 100 scale, those curves would look like there's no error in between them whatsoever.
We just look at actual number, 2% absolute difference. If you look at the anthracycline versus no anthracyclines, in the Oxford overview data, the absolute differences are about 2 to 3% with addition of anthracyclines.
Rowan?
And I would be one that would discuss TCH and leaning more towards using it. And the basis is we've got 77 events, recurrence events. And I was impressed with the 24-4 difference in terms of congestive heart failure and acute leukemia. So even though I agree that it's early and the curves could change again, I think I've got enough safety data to say I can stand another year of the curves changing. So if the curves change next year, I think I'll still be ahead looking at the way these recurrence risks are being generated. So they got 77 events in 3 years, so I'm thinking that rate will continue. So I'm already safe for a year by this 24-4 difference in life-threatening toxicities to kind of be willing to discuss it and as more of a primary option than before, even though I recognize we're early in the follow-up.
I want to hear what Joe has to say, but first, John, we're about to launch another patterns of care study. It's going to be very interesting to see what's happened in oncologists, and I think the word's getting out. It sounds like when you met with the NSABP, you kind of felt like most people were going to come over to TCH and want to be okay with that design.
Well, actually, we had lengthy discussions with NSABP as to the design of this study, but these data basically closed all the discussions. At this point, there's no reason in a trial that TCH is not an appropriate option. So basically, fortunately, the NSABP leadership is driven by data, very scientifically astute people, and they've looked at this trial and believe the data, and they've built on that with the next trial with us.
Joe?
Well, obviously, the 06 trial is a very important trial for two reasons. First, when it was initially presented, it was the third trial clearly showing a dramatic improvement in outcome when one used adjuvant trastuzumab. And secondly, it put the TCH regimen on the table as an alternative. Notwithstanding limitations, as mentioned earlier, that the trial was really designed not to test those two trastuzumab-containing or compare them officially with regard to efficacy. It was designed to determine the two experimental regimens with trastuzumab to the standard without. But nevertheless, it still puts that regimen on the table. Has it changed my practice? Not necessarily. I still feel more comfortable with the totality of evidence from all of the studies using doxorubicin-based therapy, number one. And number two, I find that when I meet with a patient that there's just so much information to review and that they're often so overwhelmed by the components of therapy that we need to discuss, including the chemotherapy, the endocrine therapy, the radiation, the trastuzumab, additional surgery, and so forth, that I generally choose not to put this on the table unless I think it should be put on the table because of my concerns related to specific toxicities such as cardiac toxicity, et cetera.
So does that mean that all things being equal, you would not be comfortable putting somebody on this study?
Not necessarily. I think the important question is really the biological question. And there's a trade-off. There does appear to be more relapses thus far with TCH. On the other hand, there is less short-term toxicity and long-term toxicity with regard to certainly cardiac toxicity. I'm not sure yet about the leukemia, and I think we need more time before there's an answer in that regard.
John, do you agree there are more relapses on TCH?
Well, statistically, no, and the trial was designed, if both arms outperformed the control, to have a protocol-specified comparison of the two arms. And that protocol-specified comparison gives a p-value that is not even close to a trend, and in fact is going the other direction, going the appropriate direction if there's no difference between the two arms. So all I can say is the data is that they're indistinguishable in terms of efficacy, and then the safety data, I think, favors TCH.
Paul?
I wanted to make a kind of companion point rather than have a boxing match over the two regimens, is that I think for patients, this reminds me of what happened with the tamoxifen should you start it up front or the AI. I think the patient should be told the fabulously good news is that there's a new drug that's been discovered recently that phenomenally improves your outcome of this terrible subset of breast cancer. And there's two vehicles, and they're very, very close. It's Coke and Pepsi. But the good news is the patients are fabulously ahead of the game from this discovery. And I think from these data, there's been a shift in our breast group, and there are others that have thought about this more than I. There's been a shift towards more use of this new regimen. I think we conduct clinical trials to respond to the data, and this is a large, well-conducted randomized trial. The data is very compellingly pointing down a certain direction. It would be mischievous, in my view, to ignore it for the benefit of patients at this early point. So I don't think I abandon the old regimen, but more use of TCH. And certainly it's appropriate to put patients in a trial where this is the control arm, in my view, anyway.
Neil, we have a bulldozer and we're arguing about the shovels.
Right.
And I realize that for practice tomorrow, that's probably the issue, but we can't lose sight of the fact that what's really interesting here and what's really exciting is that there is a targeted therapy against HER2 that in multiple randomized trials reduces the risk that a woman will have a relapse by a huge amount.
Right.
And in the end, it may turn out that the choice of chemotherapy, and we may be able to extend this much further than these specific regimens, has very, very little importance. And we may be able to do far better from a chemotherapy standpoint, not better in terms of efficacy, but better in terms of tolerability.
Kathy?
Yeah, I think, first of all, that this is great data, that TCH is a perfectly reasonable control arm in a study. I think that's going to be a good way forward. But I raise again the question of whether the data you show with the three arms looking the same in the HER2 TOPO2 amplified suggests that that could be interpreted as saying that that group of patients would do just as well without the Herceptin but with the ACT. And what does that mean? It seems puzzling.
Well, I think before you can make any conclusions as to those data, you have to remember that this is a subgroup.
Yes,
which actually is a good prognosis subgroup. TOPO2 co-amplification means you're going to do better even on the control arm than if you don't have the co-amplification. So essentially you're at a subgroup which constitutes only 35% of the population.
Yes.
We only have 32% of the patient population that we actually have samples on to look at that question.
Mm.
And the better prognosis group with fewer events, and then you're asking us to pull differences among three regimens. So you're asking a lot of one trial, even though it is a good question. The trial is not really powered to definitively answer that question.
The next set of survey questions relates to the use of trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting, specifically in patients with smaller node-negative tumors. When asked what they would tell a patient with a 1 cm ER-negative HER2-positive tumor about the untreated risk of recurrence, the faculty answers range from a recurrence risk prediction of 10% to 35%, with a mean answer of 25%. Dr. Eric Weiner began the discussion by commenting on decisions for patients with tumors under 5 millimeters and between 5 and 10 millimeters.
There's actually a pretty big difference in terms of the volume of those tumors, and I'll draw a line in the sand at T1A. So yes, that woman with the T1B cancer, I'm going to treat with trastuzumab and some sort of chemotherapy. I actually am not at the point where I'm willing to do that in a patient with a T1A N0 tumor.
Okay, so 0.8 centimeter, but now it's ER positive.
I'm much more on the fence.
Mark?
Bottom line is, it's the trastuzumab that's going to do the lion's share of the work in terms of clinical benefit in these patients that are HER2 positive, not the endocrine therapy. So trastuzumab has to be considered the base from which you are going to formulate further combinations on top of that. If they're ER positive, then it would be reasonable to add endocrine therapy, because though HER2 is a marker for relative endocrine resistance, it doesn't mean that they don't get any benefit from endocrine therapy. They just get less benefit, but they still get some benefit. So for ER positive small tumors, HER2 amplified, I think it would be reasonable to consider an endocrine and HER2 directed combination in the absence of chemotherapy for a small tumor.
In the absence of chemotherapy. Interesting. Aman?
In patients who are HER2 new positive, if the tumor is less than a centimeter, I think the data which was presented is very interesting. The risk of recurrence is proportional to the size of the tumor. And I think we need to discuss with each patient what is their risk without therapy and what is the net benefits and what are the potential risks. And I would say that we discuss this in our planning clinic every week. There is a patient like this. And sometimes we spend 20, 30 minutes talking about that patient. And the bottom line is that we offer these things and the uncertainties to each patient and let the patient be the active participant in the decision making. There are patients who say, if it improves my odds by 1%, I am willing to accept all the other things.
What do you think about Mark's idea of in these patients considering trastuzumab without chemo?
I think that is an interesting question. There is no data to support that. I would think that we all think a lot of things should work, but when we put it to test in clinical trials, they don't.
Joe, how do you approach these patients in your practice off study, under 1 centimeter HER2 positive?
Well, as I said, we know that if they're HER2 positive, they derive much relatively greater benefit from chemotherapy. And there's no question that they would also derive benefit from trastuzumab. Really, the critical question is at what level of risk do you pull the trigger? And when you pull the trigger, do you pull it twice or do you pull it once? My concern is that if we do pull the trigger, I feel sort of obligated to use chemotherapy in combination with trastuzumab. So I need to make sure that there are circumstances where that's appropriate. There are circumstances where I have given trastuzumab with endocrine therapy alone, and those tend to be older patients who have very high-risk disease, not patients with these smaller tumors.
What about, again, sub-centimeter tumors? Are you generally treating those patients or not?
Yes, absolutely. Again, because they do have higher risk of recurrence, as we know from the Oncotype DX recurrence score. I tend to fall in Eric's camp, and I do draw a line in the sand as T1A or less, where I really say I think we don't really need to go with chemotherapy or trastuzumab in that setting.
Brian, did you present the data from HERA of the impact of ER on recurrence risk in the control arm?
I didn't present it, but I have it.
Well, Brian knows it better than I do, probably. But, I mean, the patients who had node-negative ER-positive tumors in the control arm actually had a lower recurrence risk than those with ER-negative tumors.
By a lot, Eric?
It's a couple of years. And remember, these are somewhat larger tumors. We're not talking about sub-centimeter. In order to get on HERA, you had to have a tumor that was at least a centimeter. Half of those tumors were 1 to 2 if they were node-negative, and half were greater than 2 centimeters. The difference, I think, is 10 versus 18% at 2 years.
It's that kind
so
of
it's
order.
Almost double.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why I think that ER may play some role in this decision-making.
Kathy, how do you approach these patients?
Well, it's easy for me in Ontario because I can't pay for Herceptin if they have less than a centimeter tumor.
Really?
And I can't give them Herceptin unless I give them chemotherapy. So this is all very theoretical. Left to my own devices, I would definitely give some of them who have tumors less than a centimeter Herceptin. And I would give some of them, for reasons that someone said earlier, elderly or frail, Herceptin alone. And I would give some of them Herceptin and chemotherapy, but I can't. So I expect, are you the same,
you
John?
You should move to the United States, Kathy.
Oh, maybe.
What about Mark's thought about Herceptin alone, not in older patients, but just lower risk?
Well, I think that could also be, I mean, it's less toxic, and presumably, I agree with what Mark and others have said, that it may be the main driver in these cases.
Brian, last comment?
I just wanted to point out that there is going to be a trastuzumab versus trastuzumab chemotherapy question asked. It is not in this population. It is in the older population, tumors greater than 2 centimeters, ER negative, it's called the big CAT trial, so it's going to be done through big, and it's chemo trastuzumab versus trastuzumab alone. Now, you would think instinctively, Matthew, that in the ER negative population, you would need chemo more in that kind of population, but it is being asked. Over 65, over 2 centimeters, ER negative.
Paul, last comment?
I wondered whether people would randomize patients like this into a no-treatment control arm. How many people would do that?
Below a centimeter.
How many people would randomize a patient with less than a centimeter HER2-positive tumor to a no-treatment option?
I would, because it's the only way I'll ever get to pay for it in my province. So why not?
Okay, Mark?
Paul, again, I would answer that selectively. Some patients I'd be happy to randomize, some I'd be concerned about randomizing.
Final comment, Matt?
So does anyone ever use the FinHER data of short-course trastuzumab as a consideration in, you know, a relatively low-risk patient?
Mara?
Well, I don't decide initially that I'm going to give a short course, but we do follow ejection fractions going forward. And when people drop and they're flirting around even 50, I'll sometimes say, I think you've had enough, because I really don't know how much is enough in terms of duration of trastuzumab.
So use the FinHER data to sort of justify that comfort zone.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think I heard Edith present data in the last week that there are more patients in the combined analysis that got short duration Herceptin than in the FinHER trial.
And that...
No doubt.
Okay. Yeah. In absolute numbers.
Right. And that the outcome was not as good with abbreviated trastuzumab as...
But why did they get less Herceptin? Because they're different patients.
Maybe. But we'll see. I mean...
Different in terms of what? I mean, cardiac?
Oh, they're probably different in every way. If you take the patients out of a randomized trial that didn't complete treatment, they're different in lots of ways. They're probably... Do you remember that expression from medical school about PPP? I mean, they're probably sicker or maybe have more advanced disease or they're different, that's for sure.
I guess the extension of that is that in the trials where the placebo group that were compliant have a better outcome than placebo patients who are not compliant, that's exactly the kind of data we're talking about. So in some elderly patients, we've used a short regimen based on the FinHair data. It's a little bit of a balance. In a public hospital setting, it's a cost thing. People are looking at our money, and I said, I want to give some trastuzumab, and it's a safety issue plus a cost issue, so I've been willing to do it based on that data.
What's the safety issue?
Well, if you have a cardiac concern. And it doesn't take too much in an older person to have a relative risk cardiac concern.
But most of the cardiac events, if you look at the NSABP study and all the studies, it is actually very early on. There is no delayed cardiac events which occur, say, at end of 6 months or a year down the line in the therapy. So the thing is that either the myocardium is going to show dysfunction soon after start of therapy, but duration I don't think has panned out that if you give it for a longer duration, it increases the risk of cardiac dysfunction.
Well, we're going to find out pretty soon.
And John, you know, another point that Dennis brings up is the issue of people who drop out because of post-AC drops in ejection fraction and his concern about how that factors in terms of patients not getting trastuzumab. Any thoughts on that?
Well, certainly it's a concern that there are patients who are not getting the opportunity to have what looks to be the most effective drug for this particular disease. But when you look at the 006 data, one of the potential advantages of TCH is that we're not losing such patients. And that, I think, factors into the ultimate outcomes. So at the end of the day, what you can say is those two regimens perform similarly, even though TCH does have the theoretical advantage of everyone at least gets a kick at trastuzumab. I think that when you look at the numbers, which can be 13 to over 20% of patients who have not completed their full year of trastuzumab because of the cardiotoxicity issues, it raises concerns. But in the absence that duration matters, it's still an open question how much harm that's actually doing.
The next issue discussed was the potential role of bevacizumab in the adjuvant management of patients with HER2-positive tumors and emerging data from UCLA investigators led by Dr. Pegram on the potential of combining Bev with trastuzumab. The next poll question related to the two major adjuvant trials about to be launched, one by the NSABP and BCIRG, evaluating TCH alone or with bevacizumab, and the other, the so-called ALTO trial, evaluating trastuzumab, lapatinib, or the combination or sequence of these agents with chemotherapy. About half of the think tank faculty expressed some reservations about putting patients on these studies and indicated that they would be selective in doing so. Dr. Mackey, a BCIRG leader, responded to the poll results.
I'm actually extremely encouraged by this kind of a reaction because, if you know, the data that we're talking about is 6 weeks old. And we are already shifting the majority of people to considering these novel trial designs. And so at the end of the day, anthracyclines have been something that we struggled for 25 years to actually prove mattered. We finally achieved our 4% disease-free survival advantage. Everyone is jumping up and down. And now we've got to admit that maybe there are more important issues to address, the biological questions, rather than being stuck on what is old and toxic treatment. So at the end of the day, I think that we're going to see a great deal of interest in these new trials where the biology drives the question. And I think also we're going to find increasingly that we're going to be willing to pursue regimens where, in a sense, it's sort of a withdrawal of some of the accepted past treatments because we're realizing we can't just keep on adding on to the toxicities we have by adding yet another agent.
And we'll talk about anthracyclines in HER2-negative patients. You wonder whether people are going to be using anthracyclines, period, in the adjuvant setting a couple of years from now. Kathy, what are your thoughts about the two patient kind of issues in these trials, ethical kind of informed consent issues?
Well, this data is not very old about TCH, and it would be nice to see this data published in a peer review setting before we all go galloping off into the sunset in any direction. But having said that, I think there's been logic and momentum behind this as a concept, and I think that is why you're seeing people looking toward it fairly quickly. I think this would be a reasonable trial with a reasonable control arm. I wouldn't be offended by it.
How about the Aphrodite or Alto? Would you be comfortable without trastuzumab?
I'm comfortable with both trials.
10 positive nodes?
I'm comfortable with both trials.
Rowan?
It doesn't seem to bother me that there's a split, because you're asking people in this setting the question, is that your standard therapy, one of those arms? And I think we've heard discussion the whole morning that it's hard to get any one of us to agree on any standard therapy. So I think it's a little bit of a different question. And I think it's pretty amazing that half the people are willing to go on to these studies where one could arguably say we have a standard therapy arm that's 6 weeks old or has 2 years follow-up. So I'm encouraged by that. And I think we're headed in a direction even more so, we talked about already, about leaving therapies behind, is how are we going to evaluate therapies? Because if we have things that work in advanced disease, do we want to wait 4 or 5 years for adjuvant trial? So I think this is part of this evolution of we have to get someplace else to come up with the strategy instead of saying, I'm going to wait 6 years for an adjuvant therapy trial and then I'm going to give it to my patient. So I think we're in a transition area.
So Aman, you've got a patient who's got a bunch of positive nodes. Are you comfortable with the ALTO trial that she might not get trastuzumab?
If there is a lapatinib arm, I personally would have no reservation, because I personally think that that drug, at least in the setting which we have the information, it shows substantial anti-tumor activity even in the Herceptin-resistant patient population.
Paul?
I'm extremely pleased that Aman gave that answer, because it reminds me of the ATAC trial. When it was designed and initiated, tamoxifen was abandoned completely as the 5-year adjuvant therapy and replaced by anastrozole, and a third arm was anastrozole plus tamoxifen. At the time, there had never been a patient treated in first-line therapy with metastatic disease with anastrozole. Secondly, there had never been a human being treated with a combination of anastrozole and tamoxifen. So a 9,000-patient trial was initiated in 1997 where the standard of care was abandoned in favor of a novel therapy based on a class effect. And that's what Aphrodite is. You're taking lapatinib, that it's another anti-HER2 therapy. And I think this is correct. It speaks to Rowan's point. If you try to reinvent the wheel for each and every single scenario with novel agents in a class or whatever, you're going to really slow down the rate of discovery. So I concur with Aman's answer exactly.
Brian?
I have no problems with the Aphrodite Alto arm. In fact, Kathy will tell you I was one of those that argued in the initial conference calls in favor of the lapatinib alone arm. I think the only concern I have over the TCH plus minus A is just the fact that we've only got 40 patients at the moment reported for cardiac risk with the combination. I have hardly any problems at all with the TCH going to all patients. My only concern is this potential cardiac risk there, and the fact that the database on the safety of the two is so small and it's going into a multi-center setting where you don't know what kind of patients are going to be onto it, and you know, you just can't control that.
And for that reason, I can assure you there are very strict and stringent cardiac safety measures being taken with early stopping rules.
But I think the results are tremendously exciting. I think it's the future.
Mark, how do you tease out the effect of hypertension with bevacizumab in terms of what impact that plays on the heart?
We're going to take a look at that specifically in this data set, though I suspect the numbers will be so small that we won't be able to establish any definitive association. But clearly, if you look at the relationship between myocardial oxygen consumption and myocardial work versus afterload, there's a very strong association. And you would predict by increasing hypertension with bevacizumab that you might unmask any sort of insult to the myocardium from any other agent. And that may be the mechanism behind these events that we're seeing in the combination of trastuzumab and bevacizumab. Maybe. That's just an armchair explanation without any data to support it yet. But it is interesting that if you look at all of the Avastin data in composite across all diseases, even the package insert suggests that there is a clinical congestive heart failure, a few clinical congestive heart failures that have been reported. It's a couple of percent in all of the thousands of patients from all the studies. So there is some sort of a cardiac signal buried in there in the bevacizumab safety databases.
Eric, what about the pilot studies that have been done in the ECOG looking at adjuvant bevacizumab, specifically looking at the issue of the heart? What do we know from that?
I don't think we know anything yet, but I think that we will know something relatively soon. Let me make a couple of comments. I think that we've all convinced ourselves that we're okay with Alto, I think most of us are pretty much okay with it. I don't think there's a person around the table who wouldn't like a little more data with lapatinib to be that much more comfortable. It doesn't have to be a big randomized trial in the metastatic setting comparing paclitaxel trastuzumab versus paclitaxel lapatinib. A little more preoperative data, just a little bit of something that would round out what we know. But I think it's pretty likely we will have that over the course of the next 6 or 12 months. And some of what went into designing the study as it was designed is the sense that if we didn't do it then, it just wouldn't happen. And of course, if we don't have the data that we need, or if the data from studies that are ongoing look concerning, the study will be adjusted as need be. I think for the patient who has 14 positive nodes and a HER2-positive cancer and turns to you and says, do you know that this arm with lapatinib alone will be as good? I think that the truth is we have to say that it might be better, it might not be as good, it might be the same, and we simply don't know. And ultimately, it will be up to her and her doctor to decide. I actually think the issues with the bevacizumab trial are somewhat different. I'm not bothered at all by the TCH being the control arm. I think that's an entirely acceptable control, and particularly given any concern about cardiac toxicity, I think it's, in fact, probably the best control you could have. For me, if I were faced with a woman with a small node-negative cancer, I'm not sure that I would want her to be randomized to 6 cycles of TCH plus trastuzumab plus bevacizumab. It's a lot of potential therapy for that relatively low-risk patient. And this happens in all clinical trials. We all make decisions about patients for whom we have equipoise and patients for whom we have less in the way of equipoise.
I was trying to think about examples in breast cancer where a therapy that's effective in metastatic disease really didn't work out in the adjuvant setting. In colon cancer, there's a lot of excitement about IFL. In metastatic disease, everybody started using it off study in the adjuvant setting. And the trials were a complete bust. Has that happened in any situation in breast cancer? Kathy, can you recall that ever happening?
I don't think so. Usually what you see is just an expanded version of a more muted effect in metastatic disease.
But the issue isn't whether lapatinib is clearly an effective drug in metastatic breast cancer. It's just compared to some therapies, we have fewer patients treated than we might like. But we'll have those data in the not distant future.
Mark?
There are some theoretical reservations about bringing bevacizumab into the adjuvant setting based on extrapolation from metastatic cohorts. One theoretical mechanism postulated for the efficacy of bevacizumab in combination with cytotoxics is this vascular normalization hypothesis, reduced interstitial pressures and actual paradoxical improved drug delivery into the tumor deposit. In the case of micrometastasis, you probably don't need vascular normalization to get perfectly good drug concentrations right to the tumor cells for solitary or small clusters of pre-angiogenic tumor cells. So that may be irrelevant. Number two, if you look at the Folkman hypothesis of angiogenesis, the switch occurs at a stage where the tumor is still a couple of millimeters. But in breast cancer, that may not happen for years down the line, perhaps, with dormant micrometastasis for long periods. And just giving 1 year of bevacizumab kind of bothers me that we might miss an efficacy signal by not preventing that angiogenic switch during the whole period of time the patients are at risk from that switch. Obviously, it's impractical to give it for ad nauseum for years on end. But on the other hand, the postulated mechanism of anti-angiogenesis suggests that you might want to keep it on for as long as patients are at risk.
Matt?
I hate to bark up an old tree, but it really reminds me that we need much better prognostic factors for breast cancer than what we have. Many patients do not have micrometastases, and they do not need any systemic therapy. And I think that should be a very heavy focus of biomarker research for the next couple of years. And in some senses, it's the easy experiment to do. Predicting the value of systemic therapy is actually very hard. But predicting who has aggressive disease is probably an easier thing. And we hope to present some progress in that area. And there is progress in that area ongoing.
The MYC amplification subset analysis that Paik presented is very, very exciting and provocative data, suggesting there may be a subset of MYC co-amplified, HER2-amplified patients that have such an excellent prognosis following chemotrastuzumab that it would be arguably hard to demonstrate any improvement above and beyond that already outstanding efficacy. And we talked about in many of these trial designs, should that population be excluded a priori, just on a statistical basis, to give you some statistical power to detect improvement above and beyond trastuzumab. I think so far none of us have been bold enough to do that, and the MYC data haven't been confirmed yet by other cohorts, but I suspect that it will be.
I believe that it was under discussion. For
yeah, it is. It's been discussed by all of us.
Not to treat
but
them.
None of us have actually
to
put that
in the trial.
And Mark, what if it's confirmed in one of the other trials? Will you then exclude those patients? If it's confirmed, they clearly have a very good outcome with the present therapy.
I think that it will be a consideration on a statistical basis, just in order to have study sample sizes that are logistically reasonable to complete and can be done on a time scale that is within our career. So, yeah, maybe so.
Well, it's a statistical issue. It's also an ethical issue, because, in fact, if you identify a group of patients who have such a favorable outcome,
right. Why
exposing them to an additional
agent?
Risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Eric, we will have that data in within the next year, because it is going to be done on N9831, and I'm going to do the CMIC on the HERA.
It's being done on 006 as well by Mike Press.
Excellent.
Hasn't there been also some discussion about whether, based on CMIC, you could determine the duration of trastuzumab? Soon Paik was trying to explain that to me. Brian, does that ring a bell?
Yes, it may be reflective of required duration.
Matt?
The reason for that, I thought, is that the MYC is a very strange oncogene. It causes proliferation, but it also sensitizes cells to apoptosis. And so what happens is that maybe with short course chemotherapy and trastuzumab just induce a synthetic lethal situation in the tumor whereby the tumor just dies and you then don't need any maintenance because there's no tumor left. And that's what Soon was referring to.
Joe?
Just want to emphasize something Eric said before, because I think it's really important when we're talking about clinical trials and that the selection bias issue. I mean, we clearly select patients for clinical trials, and clearly the patients that we see in our practice don't necessarily reflect that. The most obvious example of that is that if you just look at the median age of patients who participate in adjuvant chemotherapy trials, it's generally in the range of 50 to 55, and the average patient that we're seeing is between the age of 60 and 65. But I think as we layer on all these additional therapies, biological therapies, particularly therapies that can last a year that create potential for additional medical problems, the way I've sort of come to grips with this in my practice is to basically explain to patients what the best available therapy that we currently have available is, what it can do for them, and what's their risk of recurrence despite that. And I refer to that as residual risk. And I present that to the patient. I say, are you comfortable with that level of residual risk? And if you are, then standard therapy is fine for you. And if you're not, then that's the starting point where I introduce the concept of a clinical trial.
Rowan?
Just picking up from Matt's point about prognosis, and I think that's going to be the direction which will be changing adjuvant trials in the future. But I want to bring up one aspect that probably doesn't get a whole lot of attention. There's a lot of attention focused on the characteristics of the tumor, kind of genetics, makeup of the tumor, and almost nothing in oncology circles on the host. And I just would remind people that in the Women's Health Initiative, we just got the data back, haven't looked at it yet, but it's 500,000 SNPs, whole gene analysis, case control for breast cancer incidence. But of course, you'd be able to look at prognosis in that same model, and the NCI cohort consortium has individual cases, case control, whole genome analysis with the different platforms, 600,000 SNPs, and those results will be out this year. And I think the extension of that, I would be astounded if there's not some interaction with the host genomic makeup in addition to the tumor.
Mark, we are looking at host factors in the BCRG-006 adjuvant trastuzumab cohort. Specifically, we're looking at activating Fc receptors, or the Fc gamma R3a gene, which has polymorphisms that in lymphomas have been associated with response to rituximab on the basis of ADCC activity. So we're going to be looking for that as a host factor, as a predictive marker for response to trastuzumab in breast cancer, potentially depending on what the data show.
Final comment from Brian?
Well, just to pick up on Mark's and Matthew's point about duration of therapy and the fact that it may take a long time to reach the 2 millimeters or whatever, could you envision a scenario where you treated with an antiangiogenic, for instance, for 3 months up front, and then you then chose a later period, say the recurrence in the ER negative of 2 years, and gave another 3 months of the antiangiogenic as like a second adjuvant prophylactic regimen rather than dosing continuously?
I suppose that could be considered, theoretically.